like this. And by the way, Michael Creighton was a genetic engineer and studied it for a number of years before going into writing. So he knows something about what he's talking about. This is not purely fictional. Experiments have been done for at least the last 60 years in which the nucleus, which you'll remember from our last discussion if you were there, the nucleus is that part of a cell that contains the DNA, the instructions, the chromosomes that tell the cell what to become. The experiment that's done is to take the nucleus out of one critter and stick it into an egg that has been enucleated. You take an egg and you remove its nucleus just simply by sticking a needle in there and sucking it out. And then you take this nucleus out of whatever it is that you're interested in cloning and you put it inside the egg and you watch what happens. Now, if you do this, you get some fascinating results. For example, if you do this, take a cell from a young frog, very young frog, in the early tadpole stage. Let's say a stomach cell. And you take the nucleus out of that very young frog, and you put it back into a different species of frog egg. What you find is that an adult frog will develop, that is, of this species rather than the egg species. That, of course, confirms the idea that the nucleus controls the destiny of the cell. You can do this in frogs all the way up to the adult. You can take an adult frog stomach cell, for example, and stick it into an egg cell of a different species. And the egg will begin to develop, and in fact, it will continue to develop for some time. In fact, it'll go all the way to the tadpole stage, and then it'll die. It doesn't go to the adult stage. Now, when you get higher in the animal kingdom, this experiment, first of all, becomes technically more difficult. Frogs were used because the egg of the frog is humongous. You can go to any local pond. Around here, if you listen carefully, you'll hear the frogs chirping. Go to the pond this time of year, and you'll see masses of frog eggs. Amphibians lay their eggs outside the body, and they're protected by great gelatinous masses. And the frog egg itself is monstrous. It's about the size of a pea. And therefore, the nucleus also is large, and therefore the experiment becomes technically quite simple. However, if you deal with a human egg, as you may well know, the human egg is microscopic to begin with. It's very much smaller than the frog egg. And so the technical problem of removing the nucleus from the egg and transplanting nuclei is no insignificant thing. That's a real problem. Okay. However, it can be done to a limited degree. We've had some success in doing that kind of thing. But a more important phenomenon occurs, and that is that the higher you get in the animal kingdom, the less development you're able to cause to happen in the egg. So that in a human situation, or in primates other than humans, chimpanzees, where the experiment has actually been done, you can only get 2 to 4 cells formed when that egg begins to divide, and it stops then at the 2 to 4 cell stage and nothing else happens. In cows, you can get it to go to about 64 cells, or sometimes even a little bit beyond that, but not much more. Certainly not to the several trillion cells that are in the adult. Now, reptiles, you know, of which dinosaurs were presumably one, are somewhere in between. And so the experiments on reptiles are, first of all, not as easily done as they are on amphibians, and there's far fewer examples in the literature of this kind of cloning being done. But in Jurassic Park, we are not asked to believe this type of cloning. This type of cloning is what we call nuclear transplantation. You're transplanting the nucleus. In Jurassic Park, what is occurring is the DNA from this nucleus is being extracted and purified and then injected into this egg. And then we are supposedly going to get adult dinosaurs. Well, there are a number of things that make that impossible at this particular time. It's a nice fiction, exciting, but in reality is totally impossible. One of them has to do with what we talked about on Monday in my session, if you were present, and that is that the DNA that is in the cell is not in humans or reptiles naked. The DNA sits in this double helix, but the double helix is surrounded by all sorts of molecules called proteins. And those proteins are not just there for fun. They're not just there for whimsy. They are there to control the function of the DNA. They are there to make the DNA operate correctly. They are there to tell which genes to turn on at which time. And when you extract DNA from a cell, you have to rip those proteins off. So in order to do the genetic engineering that Michael Creighton is describing in his book, in order to take the DNA and fill in the gaps like he did in his book with frog DNA, you have to have purified DNA, free from proteins, to do that. You can't just do it as it sits in the chromosome. Therefore, in order to get it to function as normal DNA, you somehow would have to be able to reconstruct the proteins around the outside of it. Now, that is an impossible task. It can't be done. It is just simply an unimaginable construction problem. Okay, it is to make an analogy. It would be like when they blew up the World Trade Center, if they had been completely successful and the entire World Trade Center had blown up, and then you asked your teenager to put it back together again. That's about the complexity level that we're talking about in terms of our sophistication with the technology we have available to us to reconstruct that thing, our knowledge of the way the building blocks go together. We just don't know those things. We don't understand them. Secondly, and equally important, the DNA that they're using in the experiment that they performed is from where? How'd they get that DNA? From a mosquito that was trapped in amber, right, on some pine tree back there when the sap dripped off and captured it. Now, that is not a fiction. You can trap mosquitoes. And in fact, mosquitoes, we can take DNA out of mosquitoes and clone it. But that cloning is a different type of cloning than the type I described before. It is not nuclear transplantation. What we mean by cloning in that particular case is purified DNA. Now, what type of DNA would they be getting out of these mosquitoes? Well, a number of factors play in here. First of all, when a mosquito sucks in dinosaur blood, the dinosaur blood just doesn't sit there. It's being sucked into its digestive tract. And its digestive tract is full of enzymes that chew up blood and other foreign proteins. That's how it eats, just like your stomach chews up proteins. So first thing would happen is when the blood of the dinosaur gets into the mosquito's enzymes are going to start chewing away at it right away. Secondly, those similar types of enzymes are present that chew up the DNA. So you can get bits of DNA out of the stomach of the mosquito, but you cannot get total lengths of DNA out of the stomach. And the type of DNA that you get is adult dinosaur DNA. Now, you might say, well, that's so what? The so what is extremely important. The so what is what the science of genetic engineering allows us to understand and is really, in essence, it's one of its greatest and most powerful tools. The DNA of the adult dinosaur is not the same as the DNA of an embryonic dinosaur. And we mentioned this on Monday. And it's a good thing. I had a friend who taught with me at Concordia in Portland for a while, who had a weird mutation. He had webbed toes. Ever seen anybody with webbed toes? Sort of like a duck, okay? Between the digits, there was a fold of skin. And, you know, he would take off his shoes and show them at parties to liven up the parties. We had dull parties at Concordia. You know, you had to get your kicks where you could. At any rate, the reason he had webbed toes is because early in development, during the early fetal stages of development, at about 2.5 to 3 months, a gene is turned on in a normal person that causes what is called programmed cell death. That is, a gene in those cells between the digits, between the toes, is turned on that tells those cells to die. And his gene was evidently mutated and so didn't give off a good signal, so those cells didn't die. And as a result, he still had skin between his toes. At various stages in life, various parts of the body develop differentially. For example, you may, certainly any mother who has had a child by natural childbirth methods would recognize the fact that an infant's head is inordinately large compared to the rest of its body, as opposed to an adult head, for example. The infant head may be 25 to 30% of the total body size, body mass, in a newborn infant, whereas in the adult, it's more like 10%. And so there is obviously a spurt of growth in the brain that occurs during fetal development that is not continuous throughout life. Otherwise, we'd all look like, you know, the headless horseman with big pumpkins up here. Okay? We don't. Our noses begin to develop. Our face, when it's first formed, is completely flat. And the cells in our nose begin to develop because the genes in those cells are triggered, some of them specifically, to tell the cells to reproduce, make more nose cells. And fortunately, for most of us, I mean, some of us have more problem with that than others, fortunately, when you get to be an adolescent, those cells are told by another set of genes to shut down. And therefore, your nose quits growing. You know, Pinocchio was a story about a mutation. Not many people recognize that. It was a mutation in this gene that tells your nose to shut down. And in this particular case, it was an environmental cue, lying, that caused that gene to mutate, and therefore the nose grew. You see, it's quite simple, actually. Okay, so my point here is that, in fact, the DNA that being extracted in Creighton's book from these mosquitoes has an entirely different set of genes being played out, turned on, than does an early embryonic organism. So you could not reasonably expect the DNA from an adult dinosaur to be turned on and grow into an adult dinosaur as a result of that. We have a term for that in developmental biology, which is getting closer and more closely linked to genetic engineering all the time. And that term is kind of, I like this word. It's called totipotent. Totipotent. What that means is the DNA in the cell has total potential. Obviously, in the fertilized egg, the nucleus has total potential because it has to become, that nucleus has to become liver, and heart and gonads and toes and hair and everything else in the body. It's got to become all those things. But as you get older, that potential, and I'm talking about during early development already, that potential gets less and less as cell division occurs and you get more and more cells. So one of the first things that happens in the egg, of course, is that the egg divides in half into two cells. And does this simply by the nucleus duplicating, the chromosomes duplicating within the nucleus, the DNA duplicating within those chromosomes, and those pinching off, and the whole cell ends up splitting into two cells, each of which has an identical chromosome complement. Now, in a normal human situation, what happens is these two cells remain somewhat attached to each other. Okay, so they don't do this completely. They instead are more like this. They stay adjacent to each other. Okay. Now, some of you have a genetic trait in your families which causes the glue molecule that holds these two cells together not to be functional. And as a result, when you form these two cells, you actually form two separate cells, and then we get identical twins as a result of that. Okay? But if that kind of thing happens later in development, it becomes less and less capable of developing into an entire adult, which is why there are limits to the number of identical siblings that you can have. You don't have identical 32-plets. You know, first of all, because the mother couldn't carry them, but secondly, because the cells at 32 cells in development don't have the ability to form an adult anymore. They've already lost some of their potential. And so some of them, one of them, may be dedicated simply to the production at the 32-cell stage. One of them is dedicated to the production of your circulatory system, one to your nervous system, one to your skin, and so on. And they are set on a pathway, and that pathway is governed by turning on and turning off genes. Now, that pathway can be reversed. You can, in fact, have cells that go back to the way they were at the beginning. We call that cancer. Cancer is when an adult liver cell loses the signal that tells it it shouldn't be dividing anymore, which adult liver cells don't normally do. And so if that signal stops being made, if there's a mutation in the gene that makes that repressor, that stopper of cell division in the liver, then those cells in the liver begin to divide rapidly in an uncontrolled growth, the kind of growth you get in an early embryo. And then you have what's called a tumor. And that's cancer. And then because that tumor robs the liver of its essential nutrients and essential ingredients, and it also sometimes can actually physically oppress parts of the liver so that they don't function properly, you die from liver cancer. That's how cancer works. But to get a whole organism to do that, we would have to, that is the triggering of one gene out of about 100,000 genes in the human genome. In order to do that in the human, we would have to figure out how to do that to about 40 or 50,000 different genes. And right now, we don't know why cancer cells do that. We don't know what the triggers are. We have some clues. We have some pretty good clues. There are some genes called tumor suppressor genes that we understand a little bit about how they work. But we don't know much at all about the other kinds of genes that are controlling our developmental fate. Okay, so bottom line, in answering the first question is, I don't think you have to worry too much about creating dinosaurs like they do in Jurassic Park. I think there is an implication of this, though, and that gets us a little bit into our second point, and that is that Jurassic Park is not about dinosaurs. The movie is. The book isn't. Okay. Michael Crichton has a point to make, and his point, which he hammers home with, I might add, a sledgehammer, he is not very subtle with it, is that science is inherently evil, and that you can't trust scientists any more than any further than you can throw them. And that's interesting because he was a scientist. And I suspect, I had this discussion earlier today, but I suspect that Michael Creighton had some difficulties in science, and that's why he left science to become an author, and that's why he picks on scientists all the time, and like his other novel, Andromeda Strain, and some of the wacko things that can take place. Okay. I believe that there is a lot of hype going on about the potential genetic engineering has for modifying life in the future. And I'd like to encourage you to separate hype from reality. Okay. First of all, it's very important to understand that what genetic engineers can do is limited to modifying single genes. And the number of traits in the human body that are governed by one gene and one gene only are very minimal. There are very few of them. By far the majority of human traits, like height or weight or sexual preference or any of those kinds of things, those are governed by a series of genes. And those genes are located all over in the chromosomes. They're not bunched together. And therefore, to control any kind of complex aspect of humans, like whether they're going to be great athletes, or whether they're going to be great musicians, or whether they're going to be beautiful, or whether whatever, in order to control any of those kinds of traits, you're going to have to go miles beyond where genetic engineering is today. And it may be similar to the situation we find in physics now, where you hit an asymptote. Okay, an asymptote is a line that approaches the line but never quite touches it. We may never know the answers to those questions. We may never be able to do those kinds of things. Now, notice I said may. Now, I'm not ready to dismiss it entirely, but I suspect that as we get into this more and more, the complexity is exponentially increased, and therefore the problems become much, much more difficult to solve. And finally, with respect to this particular issue, I would caution you to remember that genetics are always working in concert with the environment. They never work in abstraction. They're never separate. Genes don't work separate from environmental cues. They are, in fact, triggered by and modified by environmental cues. In other words, two people can have the same genes for height, but one will be taller than the other due to the fact that they got better nutrition or they didn't have a disease when they were a child or something like that. Genetics merely defines the parameters. It gives you the framework within which you can work. In other words, if you do not have a gene for growth hormone, you cannot grow to be 7 foot tall, no matter how much food you eat. We can, however, genetically engineer the growth hormone gene into animals and get them to grow that tall. But that's a single gene effect, and it's one of the rare ones. Okay? By the way, stop me at any time if you don't understand what I'm talking about, or if you'd like to put in your 2 cents, I'd be glad to discuss with you about that. Yeah? Two things. All right. In the human, okay, you have two levels of control. Okay, if this is the human brain, and it's the brain stem here, and right about here, you have two little glands, one here and one beneath it. The top one is called the hypothalamus. The one beneath it is the pituitary. Okay, and most hormonal systems, and growth is regulated by a hormone, growth hormone. Most hormonal systems in the human body have sort of a safeguard backup mechanism that controls the expression. And so it's interesting that the hypothalamus, the one on top, has to secrete something called human growth hormone releasing factor, And that triggers the pituitary to secrete human growth hormone. And then that gets in the bloodstream, and it goes to the bone cells and the muscle cells and allows you to grow. So you can have two different types of dwarfism based just on this, and that is pituitary dwarfism, where there's a defect in the formation of human growth hormone, or hypothalamic dwarfism, in which the hypothalamus doesn't produce the releasing factor to trigger the pituitary. There's a third type, which is that the hormone itself must be received in the cell, and the signal must be transmitted to the DNA to trigger the right genes to cause the growth to occur. And those things in the cell, they're protein molecules in the cell that receive the signal, are called receptors. Okay? And you can have a gene for the receptor that's mutated, and then you don't get the response either. So there's several different levels at which you can affect growth. In terms of, can you make an impact on that today in humans? The answer is yes. Okay. In fact, yeah, right. In fact, while I was in graduate school, I got a grant from Monsanto Corporation to clone the human growth hormone releasing factor gene into fruit flies. The idea was to attempt to get the fruit flies to make this protein. Human growth hormone releasing factor is a protein, to make it with their yolk. And then when they laid their eggs, the eggs would be heavily laden, because 50% of the weight of the egg is yolk protein. And what I did was I hooked it onto the yolk protein. And so I by grinding up hypothalamine and extracting it, treatment with it would cost about $150,000 a year, you know, and that's kind of expensive. So if you can clone it into fruit fly eggs and get the eggs just to be harvested and get it out, you can get it for a couple of bucks. You know, it's kind of a neat deal. I terminated that research shortly after graduate school because they had figured out a different way to do it, so they decided they didn't want to fund it anymore. And a lot of people have this inherent thing about fruit flies, you know, that they're kind of icky to work with and stuff. So anyway, the answer is yes, it's been done. Growth hormone has been cloned, and releasing factor has been cloned, and you can use genetically produced growth hormone and releasing factor to treat dwarfism in children where it's recognized. The growth? Yeah, it does. Well, it varies considerably in individuals, okay? And, you know, I had a friend in college who did not have that spurt of growth hormone until he was 24. He had completely prepubescent development until age 24. Had no facial hair, had high-pitched voice, and he was short. And then at age 24, all of a sudden, for some unknown reason, his hypothalamus kicked in. And whoa, he grew 8 inches in a year, and he got facial hair and all the rest of the stuff that went along with it. So that was an example of, you know, very late onset of development. And of course, you know, you're all familiar probably with somebody in your grade school class in seventh grade who was head and shoulders above everybody else, and then by the time you're out of high school, they were shorter than everybody else. And the reason is they had an early kick on, and they quit. But there's a bell-shaped curve of what you can expect in terms of the point in age or point in development where that'll occur. Yeah. Yeah. Why don't you pose the question and let me judge it? Mm-hmm. Well, let me give an example of evidence, and it has to do with Jurassic Park, kind of, because it's kind of bizarre stuff, weird. There is a single gene in fruit flies that's called bithorax. Okay, a normal fruit fly looks like this. It's got three body parts. Okay, and it has, this is the head, and it has two big red eyes here. And this part is its thorax. And attached to its thorax, a normal fruit fly has two wings. Kill a fruit fly, they stick them out like this. If they're alive, they stick them behind their back. And then they have two little sort of fake wings down here, stubby wings, called halteres, that, you know, they're sort of don't have any function, they're just there. There's a gene, as I said, called bithorax. Okay. If that gene is mutated, this is what happens. You get two thoraces and two pairs of wings. So it looks for all the world like a dragonfly. It's just one gene mutation that does that. And you can reproduce it in the lab very easily. There's another one. The first one of these type, these class of mutations are called homeobox mutations because they're what in genetics we call higher level. They control many other genes because obviously the wing and the thorax are products of many genes. The stuff that makes the veins and the stuff that makes the webbing and the stuff that makes the shell of the thorax and all that. So bithorax is a control gene. It controls these other genes and tells them to turn on. Okay. And in this particular case, it not only tells them to turn on, but it also provides a gradient that prevents a second thorax from being made. And so when it's mutated, this second thorax can be made. The first one of these kind of homeogenes that was discovered is one called antennapedia. In antennapedia, instead of antenna coming out of here, they have legs coming out of where their antenna should be. Pardon me? Non-functional in this particular case. I mean, they have all the musculature for it, but simply because of the anatomical location, they're not functional. They can move, yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I understand where you're coming from. All I'm saying is that there is evidence that simple mutations, which are very minor in terms of the amount of DNA that's changed, have magnified results in the phenotype or in the what the thing looks like. Okay. Now that doesn't necessarily prove that you can go from one form to the next. That's an entirely different question. And I had a request from somebody else to talk about evolution and creation next week, and I might do that if you're going to be around. Oh, I know. It is for me too. I teach evolution. Let me say this. I taught evolution for the first time 2 years ago in a Lutheran college. Up until that time, we had never been allowed to discuss it under church rubrics. And we probably still couldn't if they knew I was doing it. But they don't know I'm doing it, so I'm doing it anyway. Okay. But I'm not being facetious about it or trying to downplay the importance of it. For me personally, that is a gut-wrenching kind of mental gyration that I've gone through and spiritual gyration I've gone through for 30 years. Because I was brought up strictly 6,000-year-old Earth creationist type background, and the science courses I took in college were in that framework. So this is all kind of new to me. But I'd like to do that next week when we spend more time on it, and we'll get back to Jurassic Park. Okay. Now, let me quote from the book. That's a good idea. Let him. First of all, this is a section in which Ian Malcolm is talking. Okay. Of course, he's under morphine at this point, so it may not be fully valid. No, I'll tell you the problem with engineers and scientists. Scientists have an elaborate line of something about how they are seeking to know the truth about nature, which is true, but that's not what drives them. Nobody is driven by abstractions like seeking truth. Scientists are actually preoccupied with accomplishment. So they're focused on whether they can do something. They never stop to ask if they should do something. They conveniently define such considerations as pointless. If they don't do it, somebody else will. Discovery, they believe, is inevitable. So they just try to do it first. That's the game in science. Even pure scientific discovery is an aggressive, penetrative act. It takes big equipment and it literally changes the world afterward. Particle accelerators scar the land and leave radioactive byproducts. Astronauts leave trash on the moon. There is always some proof that scientists were there making their discoveries. Discovery is always a rape of the natural world. Always. That's what he says. Okay. Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is that Ian Malcolm is Michael Crichton. That's my belief, okay? I believe that, and I'm not a literary critic. I don't do this stuff normally, you know. In fact, you know, but after reading the book, here's my interpretation of the book, and this may be way out wild and wacky, but I believe, as I said earlier, Michael Crichton got burned along the way someplace in the scientific process. I think he found out that science was not his cup of tea, and it's very simple for that to happen. It happened to me, too. Science is not my cup of tea either, which is why I'm a teacher instead of a scientist by profession now, okay? And that is that it's, for me personally, it was very difficult to justify spending 14 hours a day looking at test tubes. You know, I want to deal with people. I like to talk to people and find out what the problems are and try and solve problems and work with people. You know, and I was actually in a laboratory for 14 hours a day for 4 years, and it got to me to be to the point of absurdity for me. It takes a special person to be a scientist, and the ones that are good scientists, I give a lot of credit to, because they have to work their tails off in really tough conditions. Science is 99% blah, boring, you know, terrible stuff, and 1% aha, really. And so I'm not that altruistic, I guess. I had to do some other things. But I think what he's saying through Ian Malcolm is, I don't like science. Science has served its purpose. There's a whole section later in the book where Malcolm, specifically says science has outlived its purpose. It's no longer a valid paradigm. To try and discover what the world is all about cannot be done without desecrating the world. Therefore, we should not do it. And he talks about the fact that, you know, the female scientist, the female geologist says, well, what about the progress we've made with science? And he says, what progress? 30,000 years ago, men worked 20 hours a week and saw beautiful sunsets and drank pure water. Today, they work 50 and 60 hour weeks and all their water and sunsets are polluted. Is that progress? You know, so I believe there's definitely a connotation in the book that science is evil. Okay, and my feeling on that, and let me just get in my jabs here because we're going to run out of time, I think, and I want to allow some for discussion here. But my feeling on that is that it is throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It is true that people are working 50 hours a week and enjoying it less, probably. It's also true that the cavemen died when they were 32. 50% of their babies died in childbirth, and 30% of the mothers died in childbirth. Now, you can't have it both ways. You cannot, on one hand, say you want that kind of pristine environment, and on the other hand, say that you want good health for people. You can't do the two. You got to have always some balancing acts going on in life. There's always some kind of risk, and there's always some kind of benefit associated with it, and the lucid thing, I believe, is to look at the risks and benefits and make the best judgment you can. Now, sure, sometimes scientists goober up, but I would venture to say that his depiction of scientists as out there as money-grubbing maniacs is equivalent to describing religious people like David Koresh. You know, if you're going to paint that brush that widely, you know, obviously there are a lot of relatively moderate religious people that don't go about proclaiming themselves to be Jesus Christ. Similarly, by the scientists that I worked with at the, now I'm limited in scope, I've only worked with scientists at the University of Oregon and a couple of other institutions, but the ones that I worked with closely had as, in fact, their primary motivating factor, discovery. They loved the sense of discovery, of finding out something new. And now I was working in what are called pure sciences rather than applied sciences. That is, we were trying to find out information, just simply find out something we didn't know, without any regard to whether or not it had any practical application down the line. Okay? For example, my search for how yolk protein is controlled, or why male fruit flies don't make yolk and females do, even though they both have genes for it, was simply to answer that question. I didn't hope to raise males that could make yolk. I don't particularly care about fruit flies, other than there is a tool to answer some pretty interesting questions, I think. And that's what science is about. Unfortunately, I think, and I think the point that Creighton misses is that I don't want to take it out on these people either, but the real villains in this whole thing are maybe you and I and business in general. The villain is greed. The villain is money. You know, and I'll illustrate that in this particular way. Scientists do something that some other professionals do, but you know, other workers don't generally do. Like if you're a plumber or something like that, you usually don't go to conventions. Scientists go to conventions all the time. Like a typical scientist who's an established scientist will go to 6 or 8 conventions worldwide each year. And at those conventions, people exchange their research. My first year in graduate school, I went to 2 conferences. One was an academic conference sponsored by the academic community. And there were 800 scientists at this conference. And these guys are dedicated people, I'm telling you. This is crazy. This conference started at 7:30 in the morning. You went into a big hall. All 800 people sat in chairs. The speaker got up. Each speaker had 45 minutes. And they had typically a slide projector, so they'd turn out all the lights. And it put DNA sequences up on the screen, okay, just letters, ACGT, ACGT, you know, like thousands of letters up on the screen, which if you were in the 13th row, you couldn't see. I mean, they're just little tiny letters up there, and there's thousands of them. Well, that would go from 7:30 in the morning until 10 at night, okay, with a break for lunch of an hour and a break for dinner of an hour. And everybody would stay. They would go the whole day, and it would go for 4 days straight. You know, by the time I was in the middle of the first day, my eyes were so blurry I could hardly see this stuff. But they were dedicated, and they really exchanged ideas. And the guys up in front would bare their soul. They would let the people know what research they were doing and how they were doing it and all the details, so that if they wanted to go back to their labs and duplicate it and build on it, they could. The next conference I went to was sponsored by the American Biotechnology Association, which is the manufacturing wing. Okay? And they had a big conference. About 600 people were at it. Okay, guys would get up in front. These guys were from industry. Guys would get up in front, they'd start talking, and you'd get right to the punchline, the stuff you needed to know to duplicate the work, and they wouldn't give it to you. The reason was money, because these are patentable things. These are money in the bank to these big businesses. Okay, so money's the villain here in the scientific enterprise. Science in and of itself, in its purest form, is something that you all do all the time. It is simply discovery. It's simply an attempt to better understand what's going on in the world around you. That's science. That is the best science. And the scenes that he's describing here are when people get greedy, want to make money out of that process, and somehow, you know, better their own souls. Yeah, go ahead. But. Schizophrenic. Yeah, but well, actually, though, the funding is not dependent on application.
Okay.
Yeah, right. It's on discovery. But that's not the problem that Michael Creighton. That's not the problem that Michael Creighton is describing. He's not knocking discovery. Okay. I don't disagree with that at all. I certainly think we should be aware of it. Well, my point was that I believe Michael Creighton goes way overboard. I believe he throws the baby out with the bathwater. His conclusion is, do away with science. And my response to that is, that's crazy. Okay. Yeah, well, that's his point. I mean, all the scientists do get eaten in the novel, except for Grant, and he's the guy that goes and digs in the rocks. So he can't really do anything nasty, but it's certainly true that there is potential for abuse in science, just like there's potential for abuse in law or in theology or any place else you have a profession. But that doesn't mean you want to throw the science out, because without science, we will have no cure for AIDS. Without science, you would have not wiped out smallpox from the face of the earth, you know? And I'm not sure that we want to envision a world in which there is no hope for these kinds of situations, because they will continue to arise because of evolution. One of the very fundamental proofs that evolution occurs on at least that level is the fact that new diseases arise constantly that we've never had before. AIDS is one of those, okay? And, you know, I don't know if you live in Seattle, the Jack in the Box E. coli outbreak. What was that? That was a mutant E. coli. It was a bacteria, Escherichia coli, that's normally found in human intestine. It underwent a genetic mutation and became this terrible, virulent strain that killed people. You know, that tells you something about vegetarianism or something, I guess, but. You can get it that way too, I guess. Okay? All right. I think maybe I'll just open it to more questions, since I think we're getting into the heart of the thing anyway. Go ahead, in the back.